you for joining us on another episode of Popcorn for Breakfast. With me, as always, my co-host, Kirk.
Top of the morning to ya.
Top of the evening to you, Kirk.
Well,
what do they say for that?
Over here in Ireland, you see, it's very much almost morning.
You're going time zone accurate. Wow.
That's right. It's about, let's say 3 or 4. I'm just waking up, actually.
I like it. That's a new level for you, Kirk, just going like straight. You're like, no, I'm in Ireland. Like, I am there, the time zone, the whole deal. Wow.
That's right. I live and breathe it, and I can smell it. You can't smell it through this microphone here. But I promise you, it's very, very lovely here in Ireland.
What does it smell like? Is that Irish Spring deodorant body wash? Is that what it smells like?
The body wash. It exactly smells just like the body
that's
wash.
That's what I've always assumed. Otherwise, you know, it's spring in Ireland. I mean, why else would they call it Irish Spring?
That's right. Potatoes and Irish Spring.
Just smells like potatoes and beer.
A very fresh, drunk potato is what it smells like over here. I love it.
Love it. And I'm your other co-host, Cam, and you're probably wondering what this Irish bit is about, but we'll go ahead.
We'll never tell you. You just have to.
I know. I thought about it. I was like, maybe I should bury the lead a little bit more. No, we're gonna resolve that mystery now, which is that we are resuming our series of reviewing Oscar Best Picture nominees with The Banshees of Inisherin. Fun fact, we tried to record this a few weeks ago, and now it is a lost episode. We spent like 2 hours trying to record it, had every manner of technical issue. It was a disaster. And then we finally were like, screw it. But
we did.
I don't know. So we're back. And let's just everybody cross everything, fingers, toes, whatever you can, anything you can to help us through this difficult time.
Cross your potatoes. We're about to get into it.
Cross your taters. So yeah, we're going to, review The Banshees of Inisherin, certainly one of the most buzzy movies around award season. It's done extremely well. I think they just had the BAFTAs. Is that what just happened, Kirk? And
that is correct.
Carrie Condon and Barry Keoghan, I always pronounce that wrong. Keoghan is how he said his name is pronounced. I pronounced it for the longest time Keown because I read that somewhere, but that's not right. It's Keoghan. Mm-hmm. They both took home awards, so maybe it's gaining some momentum heading into Oscar season. People always forget, Kirk, that once the nominees are announced, it's not necessarily who the front runner is when the nominees are announced, because there's a whole month and a half of jockeying for position and politicking and studios doing For Your Consideration campaigns and the like. There's still quite a bit of movement that can happen.
That's right. There's all the time in the world for all these people to rewatch them for the first time, rewatch them or watch them for the first time, and then really make those decisions to say, you know what, when I rank them, these 10 up against one another, I thought it was going to be X movie. It's actually Y movie that I'm voting for. So crazy things can happen.
Absolutely. And The Banshees is no doubt a dead serious contender this year, nominated for a whopping 9 Oscars, including 4 nominations for acting awards, including Best Actress in a Supporting Role, Carrie Condon, Best Performance by an Actor in a Leading Role, Colin Farrell, 2 Supporting Actor nominations in Brendan Gleeson, Barry Keoghan. Martin McDonagh was nominated for both directing and original screenplay, and then it also got nominated, obviously, for Best Picture, which is why we're here tonight, as well as Carter Burwell's score was nominated, and Best Achievement in Film Editing. So 9 nominees, 9 nominations. I think that's only bested by Everything Everywhere all at once. And I think it's tied with All Quiet on the Western Front, if I remember correctly, but it's been a while since I looked all that stuff up. But definitely a dead serious contender, and we are going to get into it now. Are you ready, Kirk?
I'm ready. Who's kicking us off here with the synopsis?
I believe the universe is right on point here, because it's actually you, Kirk. You're the one who's supposed to lead us on this journey. And who else could have been more appropriate?
I can't believe this. I'd like to thank my mother, my father, Cam. That's it.
Aw, that was nice of you to thank me. So considerate.
Oh, my wife, my kids, the Lord.
Uh-oh.
Here we go. Once upon a time, in late March of 1923, amidst the many Irish wars, I'm talking, there were a lot, two friends, long friends, named Powrick and Combe, these two lads, they began fighting, or where I like to say it, where I'm from, Ireland, they began rowing. It was a bit one-sided, though, I saw it anyway. Oh, and then there's Siobhan, Powrick's sister. She's got something up her sleeve about getting off the island, but I can't seem to see her leaving her brother alone. And then there's Dominic, the policeman's abused and beaten son. He's there in this tale, and it's just a tale of people who have been having enough of what they have and longing for things that they want and losing themselves a bit and growing a bit. And sometimes you just have to lose a few fingers to get your best friend back. Or do you? Well, I'll tell you, it's an Irish tale if I ever seen one before. The Banshees of Inisherin, now streaming.
Where?
Oh, on the on the HBO Max.
There you go. Decided to throw you a little pop quiz there. Yes, thank you. It is streaming on HBO Max, and for that reason, and the fact that we do this for most of our reviews, we will be discussing spoilers unless otherwise stated. So this is not a spoiler-free review. We're going to be getting into it. So if you have not seen the movie and you're worried about getting spoiled, go watch it and then come back and join us for our review. It's going to be a good discussion. Yeah, let's get started. This is interesting. The timing of this was so funny because I saw this movie and then a few weeks later I started the 52-week movie challenge, which we're doing on TikTok right now. And the first movie that I picked was The Wind That Shakes the Barley, which is set in almost is set at the exact same time as this film during the Irish War of Independence into the Irish Civil War, and it's kind of the perfect precursor to this movie in terms of historical context. So one of these days, Kirk, you and me need to make a list on Letterboxd. It probably already exists because Letterboxd is amazing, and somebody's probably already done this, but like, if you want to watch the entire Irish
conflict
history, all through all the conflicts from the 20s into the 60s into the Troubles into the Civil War in Northern Ireland, yada yada. Here are the movies you need to watch in this order. I think that could be a good time, and this would definitely be in there.
All the way to The Irishman with.
Then we just transition to movies that have Irish people or Irish characters, and then the list just gets ridiculous from there.
Yes, The Luck of the Irish, the Disney Channel original
movie. Oh no. Oh no. Yeah. I totally forgot about that one. Jeez.
We have a commercial of Lucky Charms.
They're after me, Lucky Charms. That's basically the only time I can do an Irish accent is whenever I'm copying the leprechaun from the Lucky Charms commercial. So
yes.
Okay, let's get into this movie. As we said, four actors in this cast were nominated for Academy Awards. That's insane. It's the four actors with the most screen time in the movie. You don't see that often. So needless to say, it is going to be full of tough choices tonight, Kirk. We're going to have to leave some people out in the cold that really don't deserve it. But Kirk, I want to know who your Oscar is going to for The Banshees of Inisherin.
This one is easy. This one goes to my boy, Mr. Colin Farrell. I've been watching Colin for a long time from his breakout films such as, oh gosh, SWAT, Daredevil. just all the way back from the moment that he first graced the screen to his fall to his rise back in indie movies. And I just knew that there was more to this guy. And I've been just on the hype train of Colin Farrell, knowing that he was coming back. And it really took, not cast him aside, but I really understood that he needed to get away from blockbuster films in that phase of his career. And then I accidentally stumbled upon his indie stuff when you really didn't have an option to find stuff like that very easily. It just kind of came on in the middle of the night, ironically on HBO. And I was like, holy cow, that's Colin Farrell. And I watched it and I was like, he's really good. He's actually really, really good. And he just continues to just be an amazing actor and just continuously changing and crafting what he has. I so much love the transformation he goes in this. We meet him literally in front of a rainbow at the beginning of this film. And at the end of it, he's standing in front of the burning down house of his former best friend. It's so chaotic and so beautiful to show this world of his. Probably my absolute favorite, strongest scene of his is they tee it up perfectly. They say, you know, Colm is very angry that he doesn't like him anymore, doesn't find him interesting anymore, but he really likes him when he's drunk. That's the time that he's most interesting. And in the bar, when he does get a little bit drunk because he's had it with Colm not talking to him, you see just this mask fall off of him, which is also set up earlier when he puts a mask over his face in Colm's house. This mask falls off of him of this kindness and people pleasing, and he just lays into him exactly what he's feeling. And it's such a perfect moment of honesty. It doesn't really get to cruel. There's a little bit of annoyance in there, a little bit of frustration, but at no point does he just start degrading him for no reason. It's really about his frustration with they were friends and now they're not. And I just love just every single thing was planned out so perfectly. The transformation was so great. It was very real. He had real remorse through it all. And I just can't think of such a perfectly balanced performance of a story arc from start to finish with zero hiccups for me. So Colin Farrell, you get the Oscar tonight for me.
I love that pick. Oscar nominee Colin Farrell. Maybe he'll take home the big award, Kirk. If not, at least he gets our fake awards that we give out on this show. So yes. I mean, that's worth its weight in gold, I'd say. I'm going with Colin Farrell as well. Kirk had hit so many great points. I don't know that I have a ton to build on it, but what I will just say is that Kirk talked about the arc of this character, which is really a superb arc, and it's not a complex arc for the character. It's fairly linear in how it goes. But what I love about it is that Colin Farrell, you know, makes it feel, you don't even realize the journey that you're on until the end. And then you look back at the beginning and you're like, holy crap, this is a totally different person than who started this movie. And that is a pretty remarkable feat to achieve when you can take somebody on this whole character journey and the whole time they're not thinking, oh, he's changing, something's happening, things are different. But then they, you know, as you're kind of trying to make your peace with the film and understand what you just watched, you're like, wait, remember at the beginning, he was a happy lad. He was literally under a rainbow. He was, you know, hanging out with his animals and trying to hang out, grab a pint with his friend at the pub. And then all of a sudden it just all went downhill and in this kind of descent into madness. And it all feels rational and right in the context of this movie, to the point where like he's burning down Colm Sonny Larry's house with him in it, hopefully. And you're just like, yeah, that makes sense for this character, even though that's like insanely far off beat from where you actually started the movie. So for Colin Farrell to be able to take us on that journey, and at least for me to not totally be aware of where he was taking me, it's just an amazing feat. And this is a great example of Colin Farrell's range as an actor. I think a lot of people see him as kind of like kind of a broody, dark kind of character. And I think that we've learned over the years, as Kirk has said, as he's kind of revitalized his career by starting to rebuild his image through indie films and now getting into a mix of mainstream and indie. He's got a ton of range. This is a perfect example of that. This is not an easy role. Even though it may come across as like kind of gimmicky and at the beginning, you almost think it's going to be kind of a one note performance throughout, but he just evolves it into something that's so layered and so complex. And just does a brilliant job with it. So he deserves all the accolades. I think he'll have a hard time taking home the big award on Oscar Sunday because of what's going on with Austin Butler and Brendan Fraser. I mean, it's kind of been a two-horse race there, but he 100% deserves to be there. And if he took home the award, I wouldn't even be kind of mad. I would be happy for him. So
good job. I would even say, I don't know. I think he could be sliding into spot number two to fight it out with Austin Butler.
But nobody's beating Austin Butler though, right?
Not yet. Not yet. You're going to have a pretty scathing expose on Austin Butler for him to not win the Oscar.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I know there was a lot of weird people saying Austin Butler is stuck as Elvis, and I wondered if that like press wave would knock him down at some point, but it hasn't seemed to yet.
No. And he's even addressed it. He's even said that he damaged his vocal cords, and that's why he sits in it still a little bit, and he's working on it. So he's probably got a vocal coach. He's probably got a nutritionist where they're figuring out how to reshape his voice. But yeah, I mean, go check out our Elvis review for more Austin Butler.
That's right. All right, let's move on to Scene Stealer and talk about some of the other characters in this movie. Almost guaranteeing now that one of our Oscar nominees will be left out of our superlative categories, Kirk, but I need to know who you're going with for your Scene Stealer.
It's going to be Miss Carrie Condon. She is phenomenal. Absolutely phenomenal in this role. I feel like she's been in so many different things throughout her career, but never to this level of in the spotlight. And it's very easy to think that, okay, you've got these two, you've got Colin Farrell, you've got Dom Hall, you're thinking, his father, Brendan Gleeson, you've got those two. They've been heavy hitters together back in Bruges. That's why they brought them together again, because the chemistry is so good. You throw in a female character to balance out the triangle, right? No. She is so important to both of these men's story, and she makes it very clear that her direction, that her needs, that her wants in life are affecting everyone. I can't get enough of everything that she's doing in this role. She demands the attention of the camera. She sits still in moments where you're like, oh man, I thought we were going to move, and we're not moving. We are staring directly into her soul, and it's incredible to watch. Just really, really perfect beats all across the board for Carrie. And I'm so, so thankful that she got this. I didn't even know how incredible she was. So every time she came on the screen, I was glued to it. Carrie, you deserve this win at the Oscars. You're my Scene Stealer.
I love it. It's a great pick. It's a great pick. It was almost my pick. I went back and forth so hard on all of these, and even into the final few days here, just couldn't totally decide where to go, but I'm ending up going with Brendan Gleeson. I love Brendan Gleeson. He's collaborated with Martin McDonagh before on In Bruges, also with Colin Farrell, and they just have a great working relationship. Brendan Gleeson's character, I mean, to really understand both of these characters and what they mean in the story is to understand the overall allegory that is going on here as this is sort of a metaphor, an allegory for the Irish Civil War, and trying to show us how two people who were friends, who are seemingly very similar from the same town, could turn against each other and want to hurt each other and do ridiculous things. And, you know, on the Colin Farrell side of it, you can kind of see what drives him insane. He wants to be liked, and he can't understand how somebody who just liked him yesterday and was his best friend going to the pub with him all the time didn't. And that drives him insane. And I think it would drive any one of us insane. But Brendan Gleeson's character is a little bit harder, I think, to understand. And he gives a really nuanced performance to kind of leave a lot of things up to interpretation with his character. But the way that I sort of look at it is they're at the same time an allegory for the Civil War in Ireland, but also like the two sides of human motivation, I guess. Like on the one hand, you've got Colin Farrell, who wants to be liked by everybody, but on the other hand, you've got Brendan Gleeson, who also wants to be liked, but is more concerned with legacy and is more concerned with ambition and drive. Colin Farrell's character doesn't have any ambition. He just wants to have a good time. Brendan Gleeson's character can't stand that. He has only ambition. He has to be a great songwriter, a great fiddle player, a great musician. And the pressure of that gets to him. And that's why he ends up breaking off his relationship with Colin Farrell. And as he goes through the movie, he you know, the sort of the overarching plot that happens is that every time Colin Farrell's character bothers him, he cuts off one of his fingers and he presents it to Colin Farrell's character, Paruk. And so he ends up losing all of his fingers. And there's something there that happens, and it's on his fiddle hand. So he can no longer play the fiddle because all of his fingers are gone. And I think that part of that, and the way that his character, the way he kind of shows his character, is that he wanted his fingers gone so he wouldn't have the pressure of being a successful fiddle player because he can't do it. And he has to have somebody else take that drive away from him. He can't have it be his fault because then he's a failure. If it's Pyrrhic's fault, then it just fuels his fire towards Pyrrhic and also accomplishes the goal of him not wanting to be, you know, not having this pressure anymore. And so it's this very complex internal dialogue that he's having with this ridiculous set of circumstances that would never happen. I mean, somebody chopping off their fingers and throwing them at their friend's door. It's crazy, but it works on different levels. It works on multiple different levels. And that's when you know that something's really well written, is that this works both as an allegory for what's happening in Ireland at the time in the early 1920s, but also as just a good old fashioned story of two different types of people, character foils, and how they're dealing with their own conflicts. So Brendan Gleeson always gives amazingly understated performances. He's never flashy, but he always does exactly what he's supposed to do to deliver the desired effect. He's always insanely disciplined, always very intentional, and he doesn't get enough praise for the work that he does. He's been around for a long time, and he deserves it. So Brendan Gleeson, scene stealer.
I love what you said there about the friends, about against the backdrop of the war happening. You have how could people who live in the same place and seemingly should probably have the same values, or if they don't, it would bring them to literally kill each other. And so then you have these two friends who have been friends forever. They do everything together, and all of a sudden, now they're not, and they, in their own way, have their own war going on their other side of the island. I love how subtle it is, how they bring the war in, how they mention it, and then they look away, and they're disgusted and horrified by it and terrified by it. And yet what's in front of them is so similar, and they can't seem to fix it, even though they want it. They want the war to be fixed. They want their relationship to be fixed, and neither are fixed by the time we get to the end of this movie. And it's such an incredible parallel. I love it.
There's this great scene that kind of underpins the whole thing in the pub when Pyrrhic's getting ready to confront, when he's getting drunk and he's getting ready to confront Calm Sonny Larry on the other side of the pub because he's had enough and he's ready. He's, you know, no more Mr. Nice Guy. You know, he's going to go yell at him and give him a piece of his mind. And he's talking, Brendan Gleeson's character, Colm, is talking to the sheriff of the town or the policeman who is Dominic's dad. And he's the sheriff is kind of bragging about how he's been called over to the mainland to go help with executions. And they're going to give him money and a sandwich. And he's like, oh, it's so great. And Colm's like, well, who are you executing? And he's like, I don't know, treaty supporters or the other side, doesn't matter. He's like, so it doesn't matter who you're executing for what side? And he's like, for this much money and a free meal? No, it does not. And Colm can't really wrap his head around that, but he also can't see the irony and the redundancy that's happening there, where Colm doesn't actually know that the beef that he has is not with Pyrrhic, it's with himself. You know, that's the real problem. And the guy even says, the sheriff, he's like, why do we have to fight each other? Wasn't it more fun when we were all just going against the British? Now I can't keep up with who's against who. And that's kind of, you know, it's the microcosm of this whole story. So it's just, man, it's well written. It's really well written. There's so much, so much in it. All right, where are we at now, Kirk? Showstopper?
Showstopper.
All right, hit me.
I'm going to hit you straight through this screen. My showstopper, a couple of little things here that really just stood out to me. I love the use of color in this film. Obviously, it'd be easy to just use green galore everywhere for Ireland, and the roaming, sloping hills and the mountainsides and the cliffs and butting up against the ocean. I absolutely love the scenery in here. But more specifically, we have very intentional windows and rooms. There's like a gray neutral zone for the bar where we don't get a lot of fighting inside the bar because that's a place of neutrality. When they do confront each other, it is bathed in this orange from the fire, right? So the gray is kind of ripped away, and there's this anger that's built up that has to be released, and the whole place could burn down. Literally later, but not the bar. And then we have yellow and red and green all kind of happening mostly inside of Colm's house. We see Colm's house is yellow, which would kind of give you vibes and feelings of wisdom, right? Because he is the older one of the friends. But it also, yellow in film evokes kind of obsession or idealization, which of course Colm absolutely has these two things. So I love that yellow was picked for his dormitory. Like everything surrounding him directly in front of his eyes just screams, I want to be somewhere where I'm not, and I'm going to do anything it takes to get there. And like Cam said, the only thing that's going to stop me is myself, but I'm going to put something in my way in order for me to still control the situation by cutting off my fingers, because if Powerick talks to me again, I love that there's red. The window frame is red, right? And of Colm's house, and which gives this this excitement or this passion, or of course war, right? Because we see for the very first time Powerick enter and looking for his friend. It's a yellow room, but a red window frame. And then on the opposite, he's got a green window frame over at his house, over at Powerick's house. And green, of course, is a little bit uneasy. Think of Vertigo. There's lots of green in the film Vertigo. It's a little bit discomforting, not really sure where the ground is. And there's just so much with individual colors throughout the film, who's wearing what at what time when a certain conversation is happening. And I could talk literally every scene by scene and be like, oh, look at the green. Oh, look at the purple. It's just so fun for me. So if you haven't watched it and you don't care about spoilers, or if you have watched it and you're like, you know what? I'm definitely going to watch it again. Myself, I've seen it 3 times. And every time I catch something new and I'm like, look at that. So the colors in this film are really out of this world and perfectly placed.
I love it. I love a good color palette, Kirk. Some good color grading. Using color to tell a story. It's always good. It's never fails. It's always there for you whenever you got a good director behind mm-hmm. Behind the camera. So good stuff. I'm going to go with the overall style of this movie. Martin McDonagh is a celebrated playwright and screenwriter. His plays have won so many awards and have been so long running at London's West End, which is the UK version of Broadway. He's extremely decorated and just a fabulous writer. If you've been lucky enough to see, I think the 6 films that he's written, maybe 5 or 6, he really does an incredible job. But the style of this movie is really it's part tragedy, part farce. It's a black comedy, so it has a lot of darkness to it. But he really adheres to some pretty like Shakespearean principles in his storytelling, with this being a tragedy. This is in many ways an anti-war film, I think, which is, it's not the only anti-war film that's nominated for Best Picture this year. And it just kind of an anti-hate film, kind of just like a be kind film. And it's called The Banshees of Inisherin. And as you're watching it, you're kind of wondering like, why is this called The Banshees of Inisherin? You find out towards the end that the song that Colm has been working on, that's supposed to be his great folk song, his magnum opus, he has named it The Banshees of Inisherin. And Pirate quickly says, there are no banshees in Inisherin. And he's like, I know, but I just like the way that it sounds with the S's, I guess is what he, the sh sounds. But, you know, little did they know, and staying true to like a very Shakespearean tragedy, there is a harbinger of death, a banshee, in their town, in Mrs. McCormick, and she's sort of always dressed in black, and a very clear, you know, example of what a living banshee might look like. And she appears before the deaths of this film, both Dominic's death whenever he is found, which is probably the most solemn and kind of gut-wrenching part of this whole movie, and then also for the death of Jenny, the little pony who Pyrek loved so much, and really that just it goes back to who are the real victims of war. It's the innocents, you know, it's the people who didn't ask for it. And in this little micro circumstance of war going on between Colm and Pyrek, there are still victims, and there are victims of what small town Innisharan brings out in people, Dominic being the victim of that, and Jenny being the victim of the war between Colm, Sonny, Larry, and Pyrek. So it's really well done and effective as a tragedy, as well as, a farce here and there. It does blend styles a little bit, but it's just really well structured. It's really lean. There's really no filler going on here. And I think that a lot of people see this and they're just like, it's a lot of talking. I've seen a few reviews that are just like, maybe not from critics, but from people who have watched it. They're just like, I don't get it. You know, it's just two guys being mad and kind of getting more mad at each other throughout the film, and just a lot of talking. And it's like, you kind of got to read between the lines. And once you start to sit down and really live with what they're saying, there's so much intentionality in the way that it was written. There really is no fat on this thing at all. It's trim, it's lean, and it is really, really effective. So the style, him sticking to those fundamentals on that, I think steals the show, because it just, there's a reason those styles and those frameworks exist, because they make stories, they make an effective framework for telling a story. And Martin McDonagh clearly understands that, as he's exhibited so many times. And this is another excellent piece of work in his portfolio.
It's a beautiful movie. It's just beautiful.
Yeah, I mean, we're both saying some pretty good things. We got to just flip it over to the other side now, though, Kirk, and talk about director shoes and any notes we have for Martin McDonagh.
Man, I have combed through this 3 times. And while my score will not be perfect, I do not know what I don't like about it.
Yeah, it's fair.
It's so hard. Here's what I would say. It's just coming to me now. This is live, everybody. I would say that the ending of this film does not stick with you as much as every other moment in this film. The epilogue, if you will, just kind of runs away, and then roll credits. So it doesn't have the right final punch with the right lasting moment. And maybe that's exactly what the moment should be, right? Here, that's where we're at, and life is going on and you can't do anything about it. So that would be my only criticism, that I wish that I had a final picture in my mind of where everyone was standing or walking or moving or speaking in this film. And that's it. That's all I have.
Yeah, and that's fine. I mean, here's the thing is, like, once you get into the high scores, it comes down to personal preference at that point. And sometimes it's not like, you know, just because you don't have any bones to pick with the movie, you automatically give it a 10. That's not, at least in my mind, how I score films. That's not exactly how it works, because there is a layer of personal preference that comes into play where it's like, yeah, it's dang near perfect. I don't really have any gripes with it, but it's also like not a 10 for me. So right. I think that's fair game. I think for me, the one thing, and this is ultra nitpicky because my score is really high for this movie, but it really is just that you kind of have to live with this movie a bit. There isn't, first of all, there's a bit of an accessibility barrier to fully grasping this movie, because I do feel like you have to have a pre-existing knowledge of early 20th century Irish conflicts to get the full experience. And, you know, so for a lot of people, I'm sure that comes after the fact. I mean, I was thankful to have like literally written a paper in high school about this particular Irish conflict. But I could understand that, like, if you are not close to it, or, you know, it's not the world's most well-known issue. And so if you didn't know that, the allegory piece could totally fly right over your head and you wouldn't have the full historical context to get the full payoff. So there is a bit of an accessibility gap that, like, some people just aren't going to get that piece. Whereas there are films that have really rich themes that deliver a payoff no matter who you are, because they hit you at a really, like, human level. The good thing is this film has that level too, which is it works at multiple levels, which is really, when things are really well written, that's how it should work, is that a film can work for you in different ways. It can hit different levels of understanding and interpretation. And this has that. So that is the bit of the saving grace. But you do kind of have to sit down and say, you know, either watch the film again, like I did, which is totally fine, or kind of just live with it and think about it and go back through the scenes and think to you, because each scene delivers a desired effect, but the effect changes once you know the full story, which is great, but it does kind of require you to have to revisit it at either in your mind or by physically rewatching the movie to get your full take on it. It's not the kind of movie that you see and it's all laid out there in plain daylight and it brings you to your knees and the effect is just like, wham. The effect is great and the effect gets better. It's kind of like you eat Indian food and people tell you that Indian food is spicy. When you put it in your mouth, you're like, oh, that's not that spicy. But then it hits your stomach and you're like, oh, you know, you kind of have to like literally digest it to understand what is going on. It's a bit more layered. So that's my one gripe. I think in my perfect world, like a perfect movie would be something that you sit down, you watch it, you get the full effect right at the end. You're able to put all the pieces together so that you have your final impact there. This movie can't really deliver that, but that doesn't mean that it's poorly done.
Right, right. It's if you need an education on parts of the story, can you interweave that into the exposition, it's a narrative, whether it is Chiron text, whether the characters themselves are explaining it a little bit more in depth. So yeah, you're absolutely right. There is a little bit of world history that is necessary going into this.
It's hard too, because like, you know, as you say that, it's like if there was a voiceover or on-screen silent text or something like that at the beginning, it would have kind of cheapened it too.
Yeah.
So it's like it's just one of those things. I understand the choices that were made and why, and I don't know that I would have done anything different, but it just, there is something a little bit that's not fully attainable the first time you watch it through.
You bet. And now, oh, it's time for the scores game.
It's time. I'm ready.
Oh, man. This is incredible. I want to tell you about the three times that I watched this film. The first time I watched it, I was knocking on death's door. I had influenza A, 102 fever. This thing premiered on, was released to streaming on my birthday. But I watched it the night before, so December 13th at 3 a.m. Central Time. I turned this thing on because I couldn't sleep, and I watched it, and I loved it immediately. And then I watched it again before we were going to attempt to record this the first time, and I was like, whoa, I missed so much, and I loved it then, and I love it more now. And then I watched it a third time with my wife, love her so much. This was not her movie. I don't think she would discredit this movie for all of its incredible acting or production. I don't think that. It just wasn't for her, and that's perfectly fine. But I even loved it more. I found myself trying to negotiate with her. I was like, what about the Banshee, the Oracle Lady? What about Jenny? What about the fingers? You know, every little bit.
Yes, what about Jenny? What about Jenny?
Yes, I mean,
Jenny's the best.
Rest in peace. That gutted me just as much as it did for Barry Keoghan. But I think where this movie lands for me is so incredibly high because of A, my Irish heritage, and B, I can see both sides of these characters so well. I could see parts of my life, most of my life, living as Colin Farrell, as Powerick, and I could see the other side too of this ambition and trying to cut people out of my life and saying, I need more, you know, and then realizing, oh, well, maybe I was kind of a jerk about that. And finding the middle of it, which neither of them can quite grasp, much like the war, I just loved how relatable every single character was across the board for me, minus the disgusting ones, such as the policeman, but the real ones, the main characters, our four nominees going into this Oscars. This is something that I will share over and over again to friends, to family, to strangers. I would not be upset if this won most of the awards that it's nominated for. I'm giving this a 9.8 out of 10 kernels today.
Big bucks. Bow, bow. Cha-ching. I need some more sound effects. I'm just going to make them. I'm just going to say things.
Big bucks.
That's awesome. I love it. Great score. My score for this movie is also exceptionally high, also in the nines. I really have loved most of what Martin McDonagh has done. Three Billboards, In Bruges, Seven Psychopaths. Great writer. He's really got a knack, an absolute knack for storytelling and just a way to really just break down the walls and create vulnerability and just have you not really know where he's taking you. You feel like at the beginning, you feel so sure of yourself. You're like, I've got this figured out. I'm all right. And then 30 minutes later, you're like, where am I? What's happening? This is so amazing. That's just kind of the experience. And that's how you know that it's so well done. I'm thrilled that he got nominated for Best Director. I think it's absolutely deserved. I think, you know, a lot of times people think of him as a writer director and more emphasis on the writer than director, but this dude can flat out direct a movie. It's insanely good. The performances were incredible. I had this as my fourth favorite film from 2022, behind Everything Everywhere, After Sun, and The Batman. And I still feel very comfortable with that. And I'm giving this one a 9.3 out of 10 kernels. So
look at those numbers.
Those are big. Those are big. I mean, I can't remember the last time we talked about a movie and we were throwing out scores that high. It's been a minute. It might be Everything Everywhere. That might be the last time that we really threw out double nines.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. I think so.
So that's it. That's The Banshees of Inisherin. Glowing reviews from both of us. I think if you watched it and you have thoughts, I want to talk to you about it because I feel like there's just so much here and there are so many layers to this. And Kirk and I have, this movie's been out for a while, so we've discussed it in passing, but never really had the full deep dive until now. And I feel like even as Kirk was talking, I kind of want to watch this again because I feel like there's even more that's there to be unearthed. And that's splendid. I love it whenever you can just like keep revisiting and you find something new every time. There are certain movies like that. This one feels like it's one of those movies because I've watched it twice and both times came at it from a totally different perspective. And both times it was super fulfilling.
That's right, Cam. It's kind of like an onion. You just peel it back and just keeps coming in more and more layers and more layers.
Or like a cake, right? Isn't that what they say in Shrek? Cakes have layers, onions have layers.
Cakes have layers. You know, you've got the sponge. You've got the...
And Shrek is Irish, right? Or Scottish?
I think he's a bit Scottish.
I can never get that right. It's lost on me.
Oh, give me long enough. I'll turn this accent Indian in just a little bit. So we got to get out of here.
there's like a very narrow line between those. You got to be really careful. But that's all we've got for you this week. Thank you guys so much for listening. We've got a couple more weeks till the Oscars. And I got to be honest, we got a lot of movies to review, including what I assume will be the subject of next week's review, Cocaine Bear, and we still have four more Best Picture nominees to review, so get ready. There'll be more reviews coming your way. Our promise to you is that we're going to get you ready for the Oscars by reviewing all 10 nominees. We're getting there. We got a couple weeks left to seal the deal, but stay tuned for programming announcements for next week in terms of what we will be reviewing. I'm actually out of town on business next week, so we might be recording a few over the weekend to release throughout the week. We'll see. But
we're going to record 7 episodes. You're going to get one every day.
Yeah. We'll just record all the remaining Best Picture nominees plus a Cocaine Bear review, and we're just going to release them all at once on the same day. That is what I like to call really good podcast work and branding and marketing. That's solid.
You won't work at all that day. You will just listen to us.
That's right. But until that time, we will keep you guys apprised on social media of what our plans are for programming next week. But we're going to leave you with the sounds of Rhetoric, the band who created our original music. And a special thanks to our executive producer, Ryan Spriggs. We will see you all next week.
Talk to you then.